It's prepared by Sue Ann Zollinger, with help from John Harris at the George C. Page Museum. I'm Don Glass.
And I'm Yael Cassander.
It's 20 before 3 o'clock, and in sports this afternoon, the Chicago Bulls are in New York for a matchup tonight against the Knicks. They'll try to get over yesterday's home loss to the Sacramento Kings after they blew a huge lead. They were up by 35 last night in the third quarter, but rookie guard Tyreke Evans and the Kings stole the momentum and rallied to win by 4. University of Illinois' men's basketball team continues to prepare for tomorrow night's annual bragging rights game that takes place against Missouri in St. Louis. Chicago Bears coach Lovie Smith says he's focused not on his future, but on Monday's game against the Vikings. There's speculation that Smith's job is in jeopardy because the Bears have dropped 8 out of 10 and are missing the playoffs for the third year in a row. Meanwhile, Browns quarterback Brady Quinn will miss Cleveland's final two games with a foot injury. Coach Eric Mangini said Quinn sustained an injury to his right foot on a bootleg run during the fourth quarter of Sunday's win at Kansas City. The Browns have placed Quinn on injured reserve, ending an uneven third season for the former star at Notre Dame. Bobby Bowden says he wanted to coach another year at Florida State, but that was out as an option, in his words. Bowden told the Associated Press today he wanted to coach next season. A day after meeting with the university officials, though, Bowden announced on December 1st that he would retire following the Seminoles bowl game. The 80-year-old Bowden says he's getting over the disappointment of leaving Florida State a year earlier than he had planned. Chicago Blackhawks legend Stan Mikita says he's been the victim of identity theft. Mikita and his wife Jill say someone added online checking to one of their accounts and stole $100,000. Stan Mikita is a Blackhawks Hall of Famer and was a player when the team won the Stanley Cup in 1961. He's now a Blackhawks ambassador. The Mikitas say MB Financial Bank didn't alert the couple to the account activity. The bank has reimbursed the Mikitas, and a bank spokesman says they're cooperating with police. And that's a look at sports.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from Community Blood Services of Illinois, providing all donated blood for patients in Champaign-Urbana, Charleston-Mattoon, Danville, and Effingham. Blood donation takes only 45 minutes and saves lives. Donation information at 367-2202 or on the web at bloodservices.org.
And you're listening to The Afternoon Magazine on Illinois Public Media, a listener-supported broadcasting service of the College of Media at Illinois. It's 242. Next week is the last week you'll be able to hear what's become a very, very familiar start to many mornings across the nation.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Carl Castle. Democrats.
As long as there's been a morning edition on NPR and AM 580, Carl Castle has been the lead newscaster at the top of the hour. But next Wednesday, Castle will head to semi-retirement. He won't completely retire. He'll keep traveling to Chicago each week to announce the news quiz Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me on Saturday mornings. I got the chance to talk with Carl Castle today and ask him how he wound up in the radio business while growing up in North Carolina.
I was in high school. I was 16, and I got a summer job at the local station, filling in here and there on the air, maybe AM or FM or whatever. And that morphed into a bigger part-time job before I went off to college. I was wanting to be an entertainer, because I was doing a lot of work with the high school drama department, and that was a lot of fun. And I knew that if I could blend the two, radio and drama and comedy, that it would be a good career. Because back then, that's what so-called radio announcers, as we were called back then, would do. I'd work the morning shift. I would work the weekend shifts where you played records. You created a program. And did commercials and the news, anything that was on the log. So that stayed with me until after my family and I moved to the Washington area back in 1965. And about a year or so later, I got a call from a friend who was working at an all-news station in Arlington and said they needed a weekend part-time guy. So I could use the money, and I went over and worked there. And that morphed into a full-time job, and so I left the records behind and started a new career.
Why not look back at that point then? Because you've been a journalist since then.
I have, yes, indeed. A lot of things were happening. It was quite a learning period. We had the assassinations of Martin Luther King and Bobby Kennedy, the Vietnam War and the weekly demonstrations downtown Washington, the man on the moon, so many things, the Middle East wars, Watergate came along. it was a period where so much was happening, you did learn. You couldn't help it. And so I kept that with me when I came to NPR.
I wanted to go back and mention that one of your earliest colleagues was Charles Kuralt, who got into journalism a little bit earlier. What was working with him like in the early days for both of you, and what do you make of that time?
We were students at the University of North Carolina. Charlie was majoring in history. He wanted to be a print journalist. I was majoring in English, and I wanted to be an entertainer on the air. And I picked up as many subjects as I could. I wanted a broad background for radio. I did not take any classes in the radio TV department. Charlie did not either. But we worked with the department quite a bit with the projects they had and also with student projects. And about that time, WUNC went on the air. It was an educational station, and which now is one of the big public radio stations from North Carolina. And we were on the air 4 hours a night, and we didn't know really what we were doing. We were just kind of making it up with a faculty advisor help working with us. But Charlie was on the air there, and like I said, we did a lot of work together. He was very, very good. He had just won a national student speaking contest when he arrived in Chapel Hill. So he really had a good background. He was a good writer, and he could ad lib, and he was just very talented, and I miss him very much.
You moved into public radio at a time when public radio was still trying, you know, sort of finding itself. It was very early in the lifespan of public radio. Why make that move at that time into something that was untested, I guess, and what made you not look back?
Well, in 1975, I was in All News. I was a news director at that time, right, at WAVA in Arlington. And I got a call from a friend who was working in National Public Radio, and he needed a weekend newscaster. Same guy, by the way. So I came over and worked on the weekend for about a year or so, but I had to go back to my full-time duties at the station in Arlington. But in 1977, the owner was selling the station. So we knew we were all going to be out of jobs, and I came back to NPR looking for work, and there was an opening, and that's how I got here, and I've been here ever since.
Since then, I know people will ask, you know, what are the highlights of your time at NPR and the most challenging times? What are they to you?
Well, I think some challenging times will be when you start something new.
Mm-hmm.
For me, doing a newscast, I'd been doing it for many years over in Arlington. But when Morning Edition came on the air, you're working with a new format, a new program. How are we doing? Are we doing it right? And what can we do to improve it? Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me went through the same period when we first went on the air about 12 years ago.
Right.
So you're just you're feeling your way until you find that right combination. And then you have people who don't want you on the air because perhaps you're disrupting what they were used to before in the morning. So you get letters from them, and I'm sure the stations did also. But we finally began to make our mark, and so today, Morning Edition is the most listened to news program on the air, radio or television, in the country.
And I bet now you get lots of letters saying don't leave.
I have gotten those. I sure have.
You mentioned Wait, Wait. And you mentioned, again, a sort of an untested format. Mm-hmm. Did you have any qualms of jumping into that, being the serious newscaster?
No, not a bit, because mm-hmm. it harkened back to my years of growing up. That's the kind of radio that I listened to back in the so-called golden age of radio. Quiz shows, comedy programs, people having fun on the air. That's what I wanted to do, and this was my chance, so I grabbed it.
And you changed your weekly routine. You come to Chicago pretty much every week.
I do. I do newscasts 3 mornings, Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday, and go to Chicago Thursday morning, do the show Thursday night, and head back home on Friday morning.
Is that a challenge, or is it, you jumped at the opportunity, saying it was what you intended to get into? Is it everything you expected?
Oh, yeah. I love it. And as far as the travel is concerned, no problem. I sleep or I read on the way up and on the way back home.
Where do you see the profession of radio going from here? People have been saying for years and years, oh, radio news is dead. People don't consider radio a place where they get a lot of their news. Obviously, we'll argue against that. What do you make of the future of radio?
We still have listeners. We still have listeners by the millions out there. The data show that. I think that radio will probably go through a phase similar to what happened back when television came into being and became rather prominent. Our death notice went out then that radio was going to be gone, television's taken over. It never happened. You cannot play with your computer or watch TV while you're driving in your car, even though some people do. Radio is there. It's the way to do it.
So what will take up the portion of your time right now that you're doing the news, besides sleeping in perhaps?
Well, I will be an ambassador, roving ambassador for NPR. I will be visiting stations, doing any kind of event, fundraising, dinners, banquets, anything I can help out with, and maybe just stop in for the heck of it and say hello.
And this is a challenging time for a lot of public radio stations.
It certainly is, and I'm going to do what I can to help.
NPR newscaster Carl Castle's last newscast will be Wednesday, December 30th at 10 o'clock Central Time, but you'll still be able to hear him on Saturday mornings as the announcer and phone answering machine announcement recorder on Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me on AM 580. It's 2:52. At this time of year, golfing might be the furthest thing from people's minds, but during the off-season, golf course managers get to strategize how to best treat their million-dollar turf. Some golf courses have a bad rap with environmentalists, but as Tanya Ott reports, there's a budding green movement in the golf industry.
Golf courses take knocks for using too many chemicals and too much water. Audubon International estimates the average American golf course uses 312,000 gallons a day. Gil Rogers is with the Southern Environmental Law Center. He says that's a boatload of water.
In Georgia, they're defined as agriculture, which doesn't make any sense, but that allows them to use a lot more water than they would otherwise be able to.
That can be a problem, especially in places with water shortages. Places like Atlanta, where a federal battle over water rights might soon leave the city high and dry. Of course, on this day, water doesn't seem like much of a problem. It's been raining all night. I've come to the Stone Mountain Golf Course just outside Atlanta to talk to Superintendent Anthony Williams. He won golf's highest environmental stewardship award this year. Technicians raise the reels on the mowers to help protect the wet turf. Williams says it's been a tough fall. In October, a big storm, they called it the 500-year storm, dropped 16 inches of rain on Stone Mountain in one day. Williams says the only thing that saved his course were the acres of native plants.
When that flood literally came into the property, those plants did exactly what nature created them to do. They fluffed out, fanned out, and really just acted like a sponge.
When Williams took over a few years ago, he ripped out the non-native ornamentals and replaced them with native perennials that don't require any additional watering, just rain. Stone Mountain isn't just using less water, it's also using fewer chemicals. Williams' crew is creative. Take, for instance, one of their big problems, wild geese. They can do a lot of damage to million-dollar turf.
We refer to it as the in and out damage. The in damage is when they're actually eating the grass and physically tearing the green up. The out damage is as they're walking, well, the eaten grass becomes, goose droppings. And then the cleanup is very, very difficult.
Conventional golf courses spray foul-tasting chemicals on the grass or light fireworks overhead to scare the geese. But at Stone Mountain, their secret weapon is a 13-year-old hound dog named Cushman. When the geese see Cushman coming, they think he's a predator. William says it works like a charm. This focus on environmental stewardship is paying off financially. Anthony Williams says they're using significantly less fertilizer and insecticides. He estimates they've saved nearly $50,000 on chemicals in the last 2 years. How confident is he about the health of his golf course? I asked him if he was willing to put his course to the test. Apparently, some old-school players still lick their golf balls to clean them. Not a good idea when there are pesticides on the ground. Would Williams do it now?
There's a lot of things in nature that you probably wouldn't want to eat or put in your mouth. So the golf ball is going to encounter a lot of those along the way. I would definitely line up with the do not lick your balls. I'm going to be on that side of the fence.
More golf courses are starting to look at their environmental impact for the first time. They're planting different grasses, and nearly 1,000 U.S. golf courses use recycled or reclaimed water. Another reason not to lick your balls. For the Environment Report, I'm Tanya Ott.
We're just about halfway through our fiscal year, and we should be halfway to our annual member support goal. We're within $190,000. Your tax-deductible gift will move us closer. Give at willpledge.org or mail a check to UIF Friends of WILL, 300 North Goodwin, Urbana, 61801, and we thank you. Spain has just finished holding its annual Christmas lottery, the biggest in the world, as a total jackpot of more than $3 billion. And as this drew the tradition, school children sang the winning numbers. Just before the drawing, Jerome Sokolowski joined long lines of ticket buyers and found the lottery offers some hope for a nation mired in recession.
There are two telltale signs that Christmas is approaching in Spain. One is the villancicos, or Christmas carols. And the other is the long lines in front of the state lottery kiosks. Here on the Puerta del Sol Square in the heart of Madrid, there are three long lines of people waiting to buy tickets for the lottery known here as El Gordo. Eduardo Ramon and Miguel Vázquez are in one of them. Both are in their early 30s, still live with their parents, and lost their jobs in this recession. He's on welfare, and I don't even qualify, says Ramon. It's our only hope, he continues. Maybe we'll get a spark of luck that will get us out of this rut. The lottery is named El Gordo, or the Fat One, because of its size. Nearly $5 billion worth of tickets are sold, which on average comes out to more than $100 per inhabitant of this country. When the winning numbers are sung out, everyone is glued to their TVs, in cafes, living rooms, or at work. And the anticipation is a community experience, because tickets are often shared by friends, relatives, barmates, or work colleagues. Still, Miguel Vázquez is not very optimistic about his chances. We'll see, he sighs, but I don't think I'll be lucky. Vázquez is hardly the only 30-something in the doldrums. While overall unemployment in Spain is almost 20%, among the youngest workers, it's nearly twice that. A few years ago, the Spanish economy was the bright star in the European Union, creating a third of all new jobs. But many have evaporated, and opinion polls show that few people have faith that Spain's social